tax repeal or reform tax credits. Then I'd like to talk about the operating budget. I sent a memo to all committee chairmen, and I know I was asking for rather quick action, especially since some of you haven't had a chance to even look over the government's proposal yet. But I think it's important that at the outset, we talk about goals and what our limits are going to be. So we'll do that after the tax discussion. And if the committee members are ready, we'll deal with HCR 33, the loan resolution. But not if anyone wants another day to look at it.
Chairman, I would say to you that I've got some additional figures on that foundation funding, school funding. I'm unable at the moment to finish giving you my report, but I will as soon as possible.
One thing I want to emphasize is that I'm not asking for a prediction, which would be impossible at this point for you to predict where you're going to go. What I wanted was sort of a working goal. And you may exceed the goal or you may come under the goal, but I think that in a year like this where we've got so much money, if you don't have a goal for yourself, some sort of limit as a goal, all the budgets are going to go 50% increase. You know, it's just they're going to go really high if we don't have some sort of working goal. And that was the idea for the committee chairman, the subcommittee chairman, to put in their own limits if they had any idea what it is. And then we'll have a discussion out of the full committee.
I believe in the point, Mr. Chairman, I will point out some factors came in that I've got to consider before I give you my...
Well, in education, the governor's budget, I might point out, is totally inappropriate. It says a 2.6% increase, and we know it's going to be a lot more than that. He's not counting the foundation formula increase.
Now, this is one thing plus some figures Mr. Scott gave me that I wasn't aware of.
Okay. That's fine. As soon as you can get it to us. I'd like to have Mr. Donahue from Revenue and whoever else is with him to testify come forward and give us whatever you can of the governor's proposal. One of the problems that we've been having with the governor's proposal is that nobody knows what it is. He's been talking about it in every speech that he's made for the last 6 months, but I haven't been able to figure out what exactly he's proposing. Maybe Mr. Randolph knows. He's trying to keep track of that stuff, but I haven't been able to figure it out. We're hoping you can clarify that. And then Representative Randolph will give a short explanation of his thinking and answer questions. And Representative Freeman is working with Representative Miles and Malone, and I think Sam Cotton is also cooperating with them now to put forth a bill representing the Democratic majority's concepts in hopefully representing the Democratic majority's concepts in tax and repeal and reform. Come forward, please. Commissioner, are you going to honor us with your testimony again?
$600 million.
Yeah, we have about 6 90 marks about the $600 million that I've told the committee members to keep to themselves.
One was an apple and the other was an orange.
Yeah.
I just can't tell them apart, Alex.
Mm-hmm.
Well, for the record, again, my name is Tom Williams. I'm the Commissioner of Revenue. And with me is Josephine Donahue, Deputy Commissioner of Revenue for Taxation. We appreciate the opportunity to answer your questions today and to testify before the committee. As the chairman perhaps knows, the governor's bill is either being introduced at this very instant or is about to be introduced later this afternoon, according to the information I've just received. And so it's a little awkward stealing the governor's thunder, but I'd be glad to describe the general philosophy, if you're interested, behind the bill, but I'm not in a position to discuss the actual details.
Yeah, I apologize for putting you in that position. That wasn't the intent. We're just, if the public's very interested in this question, it's been highly touted, and I think it's appropriate that we take it up as one of the first orders of business that's been scheduled for since I first put it in our agenda. In fact, I considered canceling this discussion because, like your case, Miles and Freeman don't have their bill ready yet for introduction, although they're familiar with, of course, the concepts that they're putting forward. So we've sort of changed this discussion, rather than be one on the bills themselves, and one is the general principles and the concepts that people are approaching it. The governor's made that, some of his remarks, fairly clear what kind of concept he likes and what he doesn't like, and I'm wondering if you could give us an overview as to those questions. The question versus of direct repeal versus credit versus some other way of fully payable credit where everyone gets it.
Okay. First of all, I think the paramount concern is that there be an association formed in people's minds between the benefits that they're going to get under this and the need to have a permanent fund capture a larger portion of the revenues than the 25% now dedicated to it. In other words, it is in the people's long-term interest that the contribution rate to the permanent fund be increased, and the governor wants to see a program that is tied to that increased contribution so that people will not only understand it as an abstract proposition in the long run, but will understand it in dollars and cents that they can spend today. And as a consequence, he's got what has been called energy tax credits, and I think is now a permanent fund dividend approach, which basically takes the earnings from the permanent fund and distributes them back to people on the basis of how long they've been exposed to the harsher economic conditions that have historically prevailed in Alaska. So that 30-day wonders who have come up here and have a big boom time job do not become the prime beneficiaries of diminished income tax. In addition, one of the major obstacles that the governor sees with simple tax repeal is the inequitable distribution of the benefits back to the public. As a general matter, it's the wealthy who will benefit most. A substantial portion of the tax also will go to those who live outside of Alaska and pay income taxes here. Repeal of the tax would have to extend to them for constitutional reasons, and they naturally would enjoy the benefits. And so they would essentially come in for part-time, a fishing season or whatever it may be, go back outside, enjoy the benefits of economic activity here, gainful employment and enjoyment of our resources, while making absolutely no contribution to the welfare of the state. In addition, repeal of the tax tends to discriminate against those who have been here, have paid their taxes all along, but are now retired. Someone who's been here for paid taxes since day one for 40 years and is now 67 is not going to enjoy any benefits now because in retirement their income is not nearly what it was when they were active. Similarly, it's not going to work to the advantage of those people who are just getting started. Very seldom do you get top-level salaries for bottom-level positions, and people naturally start at the bottom and work their way up. So for new families getting a start here, this tax repeal is not going to have as direct a benefit for them as an alternative form of distribution back to the people. Further, you're going to have people who have historically enjoyed a culture based on subsistence lifestyle, which is non-monetary. It's not readily susceptible to income taxes. And consequently, forgiving taxes is not going to benefit them very directly, unless they choose to adapt their culture to the cash economy of the white man. And finally, you have a substantial segment of the population out there known as women, who, although we have increasing numbers of women who are employed and will be gaining income of their own and hence will be paying taxes of their own, who stand to enjoy this. But the single woman, or the divorced woman, or even the spouse of a gainfully employed husband may not fully realize the benefits as effectively as she would if an alternative vehicle were created to distribute the benefits back to the people. It would be possible to give everybody a uniform chunk of cash as a means of distributing that back. Take the size of the permanent fund dividends that we anticipate, or earnings, and divide one half that amount by the number of people in Alaska, and look at X dollars per capita, you could easily make a refund system that would work. Unfortunately, that treats, once again, 30-day newcomers the same as 30-year-old timers. And it's our belief that people who have been here for that time, have endured the hardships, have endured the higher costs, the inconvenience, and who have also had the opportunity, therefore, to make a greater contribution to the general welfare of the state, should enjoy a greater proportion of the benefits now that we can afford to distribute them back to the people. So the disagreement is not over distributing benefits back to the people. The disagreement is over the mechanism by which those benefits are to be distributed. It's also, as a further concern, of course, is right now we have a little less than a quarter of our current operating budget is in fact funded from an ongoing source of revenue. And when, if we repeal the personal income tax, that lopsided nature will become even more lopsided. Our dependence will be greater. And the government is not going to cut back by $130 or $160 million a year. Because the tax is repealed, the difference will be made up out of petroleum dollars, which thus will make us more dangerously dependent on them in the years to come. Already we have considerable concern about what happens if, for instance, we appropriate $900 million or $1.5 billion to the permanent fund from our present surplus and then find that there's a disruption in the pipeline. Which appropriation would have priority? To make ourselves still more dependent on that 800-mile tube of pipe, to make sure that projects are able to proceed, I think is not a prudent way of proceeding into the future. Finally, I suppose, as a last argument against a repeal, one would say that if something is free, people want more of it. It's not a truly sophistic argument then to take that proposition and say that if you make government free, people are going to insist on more government. Making them pay something keeps some interest in the governmental process. Obviously, they're not paying for all of government. And we're certainly not proposing that they pay more in order to have a greater sense of responsibility. We are agreed that the time has come to distribute directly back to the people a portion of the petroleum wealth that we are now harvesting. But at the same time, it's necessary to preserve the institutions in place that are sustainable sources of revenue. Because although we're hopeful of new discoveries of oil, we're hopeful of mineral development, all of these things are in our future. There's no doubt about it. The question is when. And the one thing we know is that development, as soon as it can come on stream, is still going to be years off in the future. Even the Beaufort Sea, which has already been leased, assuming that there's a discovery, probably will not be coming into commercial production until the latter part of this decade. So if we're talking about new deposits that are yet undiscovered, or to which issues of access, issues of land use, and so on, have not been resolved even at this stage, you're talking about longer lead time still before those can come on stream and start supplanting on a sustainable basis the one-time only revenues that we're enjoying from Prudhoe Bay. Well, that's essentially I think that covers all the points of the position regarding why we would rather see a system of credits, particularly a system of credits tied to the dividends from the permanent fund, rather than the tax. But I'd be glad to answer any questions that the chairman of the committee may have.
Let me ask you a few before I throw it open to the committee members. A couple points of clarification. In all the lists that, excuse me, that I've made and that the House leadership's made, and the House Policy Committee, and the House Caucus, we always list all the different ideas. We put down AgSoc and Alaska Inc., but we separate out tax reform or repeal. That's one issue. And another issue is direct distribution of oil well. Those, in our minds, those are separate. And isn't it really the case that it sounds to me anyway that what the governor's saying is that he's opposed to tax repeal for a number of reasons, but he's in favor of distributing the oil well, and he thinks that it should be distributed equitably to all residents and not to out-of-state people and to people who have been here longer and all the qualifications that you put in, which I certainly agree with. I think everything you've said is very reasonable, and I think most people would. But I'm just wondering if we're really kind of comparing apples and oranges again, as we often do, since that when some people talk about tax repeal, they can also be in favor of direct distribution. In my case, I favor tax reform, reduction, in the form of credits at least, and I don't know what other kind of tax reform I would favor, but I at least favor that. But I also think we should take some of the money that we have, which really belongs to all the people of the state, and figure out some way to directly benefit them, perhaps by directly distributing it to them. And if we were going to distribute it to them, we ought to do it on these, on the basis of what you're saying. So my question is, I'm trying to make this more logical. It seems to me that really the governor's pretty much opposed to tax reform and tax repeal. And if you really look at what he's talking about, he's distributing oil well, but using the tax mechanism is the only thing. And he's not even just strictly using that, because he's given it to other people besides tax.
Well, but for your last sentence, I'd say that there's a misconception that your last sentence makes it clear that you don't have a misconception. The nature of the permanent fund dividend is, in fact, a direct interface with the income tax. It reduces the income tax. It will allow, unlike a credit, where if you go below a zero tax liability, you get only refunded the amount that you paid in. You don't have a negative tax. So it goes beyond an ordinary credit by providing for that further refund. If your actual tax liability is negative, you get that paid back to you. And, you know, I think it's mostly a semantic difference to say that in one case you're distributing the money directly back to the people, and in the other you're providing, tax relief. The fact is that by foregoing the tax dollar, you know, that gets replaced with a dollar from petroleum. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there were dollar for dollar reduction in government, that might not be a bad idea. You could, I don't know where you'd want to start. I wouldn't want to volunteer too much in my department, although I suppose I'd be expected to volunteer some.
There's one other point I wish to clarify, just for clarification's sake. Could you give me what the cost would be of complete repeal of personal income taxes in terms of revenue that we wouldn't receive, and what the cost is of the governor's proposal?
Okay.
Do you have those figures?
It's in the source book. I believe we're forecasting on the order of $130 million this year and $160 million next fiscal year.
That's the total personal income tax revenue.
That's correct. 122 revised estimate for the current fiscal year, 161.
That's 122. That's what we would get in personal income tax revenue. Now, what would the governor's going to cost more than that, because he's going to give people back
$50.
Not only their taxes, but he's going to give it to people that didn't pay taxes, right? Like housewives and subsistence hunters and divorced women and all these different group that you mentioned, so that must cost more, and I'm just wondering.
Not necessarily more. You see, if you gave a dividend per year of residency since statehood, the Institute of Social and Economic Research at the University of Alaska has done some research on this, and the estimate is there would be about 2.6 million shares, or dividends, if you will. If you gave each dividend for each dividend, $50, that's $130 million, which is within $8 million of the anticipated receipts this year of the income tax. And if we appropriate additional new revenues or current balances in the general fund to the permanent fund, and in addition, up the contribution rate, we would anticipate that the income stream from a $2 billion permanent fund, even if it were invested at 10%, which the permanent fund's doing better than, but if it were just 10%, you'd have $200 million available to distribute. Half of it, of course, to be going into the general fund as a sustainable source of revenue. But another $100 million then, on an ongoing basis, that would be immediately available the next year. So,
but assuming all that, assuming that you can find ways of, you know, funding this thing through the permanent fund investment, mm-hmm. and tying the income stream to it, or however your mechanism is, what is the total cost? What is the total outlay under the program? You know?
That would be about $130 million in the first year. And thereafter, it would be, it's proposed to be one half of the income thrown off from the permanent fund. Okay. And so that's going to be a direct function of the balance of the permanent fund, as well as the yield.
Representative?
First, I'd like to have one question clear in my mind. $130 million in income tax, is that before or after the credits? This year will be $300 per person.
Our forecasts have your credits figured in.
You give the credit, you still have 130 left.
Well, 122 in this fiscal year.
Or, yeah, okay. Well, I just want to have it.
That's correct.
And, Commissioner, if I may, I'd like to pick your brain just a little. I'd like to know, because as the chairman said earlier, a couple of my colleagues and I are working on an income tax bill, and there's some information. First, let me back up just a little. In the beginning, when I first got involved with the income tax, my argument was that we had oil wealth and we were spending it, and there were a certain segment of our society that wasn't really getting a benefit. We increased the money that went to school, 70% of that goes to teacher salaries, teachers had benefit. We increased the aid to this and aid to that, those people had benefit. Done all kinds of things like this, but there was one guy who had not really received a benefit, and that was the average Joe Blow, who went to work every day, abided by the law, paid his taxes, and didn't get any aid or help from anybody. He was no better off than he was to start. So, since these people were working, people are paid income tax. Income tax seemed to be the proper vehicle to kind of spread it out. Now, there's hardly any limit to how far, well, there's a reasonable limit, how far you can go with using income tax as a vehicle. Because you can run it backwards, you can start paying, have payable cash credits, and where people get money when they haven't even earned anything, don't even have a job. You mentioned retired people, subsistence economy, and these type of things. Do we have any figures, my question is now, do we have any figures that show what kind of a percentage or benefit the, for instance, retired people, and considering my age, I'm not knocking retired people, right? But it seems obvious to me that we pay longevity bonus. You gotta be 65 years old. If you're 65 years old, your municipality will forgive your property tax and the state will reimburse it. There's any number of things. Do we have any figures somewhere that shows actually on some kind of an average what kind of benefit retired people, for instance, are really receiving at the present?
Already? I don't know.
Wouldn't you agree that when you're trying to figure out something equitable, that this would be something that we should know? I can, just for instance, and again, another example, subsistence economy. We have people that wouldn't benefit if income tax was the only vehicle because they don't have income. Are these people, what kind of benefits are they getting now that wouldn't ordinarily be available to the average guy who works at a job and pays income tax? Isn't there some kind of figure somewhere that would show what kind of money the state money at present is going into these kind of programs?
I mean, in terms of supporting education or things?
Well,
like that,
education, I don't really consider education, that's something that everybody, but
Well, if he's not paying taxes, he's enjoying governmental services that you know, there'd be presumably police protection, possibly some degree of fire protection, electrical supply, and things like that that would be made available that, as a non-payer of taxes, that person would enjoy.
Let me just use an example. Let me dream up one real quick. Let's say a man, a wife, and three children, and he has some kind of a way to make a living that doesn't involve making enough money, actually money, to pay income tax. What kind of services, my question is, would he be getting some kind of aid? Would he and his wife or children be getting some kind of aid or money from the state that normally wouldn't be available to a guy who worked at an ordinary job and paid income tax?
It's possible they could qualify for some welfare-type program that is being administered either by the federal government.
You understand the gist of my question.
I understand what you're saying.
What I'm driving at, what I'm trying to get to.
But some of these people may already be partially taken care of.
That's right. That they may be, as a consequence of not really earning a lot of money, they may be getting some benefits from the state that aren't available to other people. But, you know, I was trying to figure out some way that, you know, we could come up with some equity in this thing that was reasonable. And it occurs to me, of course, being an early advocate of, as I explained to you earlier, of the income tax as a vehicle, it also occurs to me that as long as you're dealing with people who earn income, that it's ideal. But when you start trying to use that as a vehicle to help people who don't earn income, that it gets a little out of joint. And and this, of course, this brings me around to an argument the governor makes, which is one that don't appeal to me. But that's my problem, my dilemma. But you know, I can see some of the areas that we could take care of, and that the ideas, at least that I have, that would go along very well with what the governor proposed. And I can just give you a real simple example. Let's take the income tax credit. The governor has said repeatedly, as I recall, that he would like to see the some of it kicked back based on not only on how much money you earn, as I recall his words, but also based on the length of residence. I can see some, and as long as you use the income tax as a vehicle and you work strictly with people who earn income and pay income tax, I can see all kinds of ways you can do that. For instance, as an example, you could say the law we have on the books of credits right now says the first year that you pay Alaska State income tax, not the first year that you're here, that the first year you pay, okay, you get $100 credit. Now that, if the law that's on the books right now, it wouldn't make any difference whether that you earned your first year, paid your first year's income tax this year, 10 years from now, you still only get $100 the first year. The second year you get $200, the third year you get $300. I could see that if you didn't have other problems, that you could extend that. You could say the fourth year you get $400, the fifth year you get, fifth year you get $500, and sixth year $600, and so forth. That again would, that would be a case that the 30-day wonder, the most you would get out of it would be $100 the first year,
right,
which wouldn't be any kind of enticement to bring people here. But then, when you start talking about the payable credits, that's where I begin to have problems, because it seems to me like that would be some kind of an absolute nightmare to try to figure out how you pay a guy money using income tax as a base when he didn't have any income. And of course, maybe that's a problem that somebody else would have to handle, but it seems to me like it would be a horrible thing. So I just having real problems when I start, because a lot of it is I simply don't have the facts and figures to back up to get me where I'm trying to go. Excuse me, Mr. Rogers.
Yes, sir. Tom, you compared the governor's, say, $50 a share of 2.5 million shares, which would be a cost of $130 million, as opposed to the tax repeal, which would be a cost of $122 million. But you didn't get into the cost of administering the two different kinds of plans. And it seems to me the cost of administering a tax repeal is whatever it costs to retrain 140 tax collectors. And you end up with a negative administration costs. Could you give me some ideas what you think it would cost to administer the Alaska Inc. People's Portfolio plan?
Well, first of all, the tax appeal is not going to result in 146 people being tossed out of work. And second of all, even if it were, it would not happen overnight because we still have 3-year statutes of limitations and so on. And so the audit staff that we have, the enforcement staff to collect revenues that we have, would continue to be in operation to service the tax years on which the statute of limitations is going to run. And one of the major efforts that we have is to find people out there who are making substantial sums of money who are not reporting it. They interface with the state in one area but choose not to file a W-4, for instance. They're self-employed, or they're a fisherman, or they're a game hunter, or they're a trapper, or something like that. People who are generally out in the remoter areas, there's been opportunity. But it's not confined, of course, to the rural areas. We have, I believe, significant amount of tax avoidance going on within the more urban areas of Alaska as well. The cost of administering the permanent fund dividend should actually be quite small. It would be a self-policing type of thing, much the way reporting is now for the income tax. You would apply for it. If you were found to have perjured your affidavit as to how many dividends you're entitled to receive, you forfeit all of them. That's a fairly strong deterrent against people overstating what they're entitled to, especially when you know that we're going to be able and will be actively doing auditing on a spot basis to keep people above board. It's not necessary to audit 100% in order to obtain significant compliance in that regard. It would be fairly simple matter to add such a statement to the income tax form. Now, the first year, this calendar year, 1980, how to get $130 million back to the American, or to the Alaskan people, instead of the American people through Uncle Sam. We would have to have a supplemental meeting. There's no two ways about it. So we would have some printing costs for probably 300,000 one-page affidavits. There would be the mailing cost to get it out and the mailing cost of the checks. I don't have an estimate as to that, but I would think compared to the overall operations of even a division within the department, it would be relatively minor.
And the audit expense?
The audit expense?
Yeah.
Of verifying how long people have resided?
I just remember the when we had the resident hire law and the mammoth troubles the Department of Labor had ascertaining whether or not people had been 1 year residents, and to try to ascertain overall residency, people who have broken terms of residency, people who are here for 6 months of the year, the logistics of that just really seems like it gets kind of difficult.
That would be a function of how much money you wanted to spend to ensure compliance. I mean, the more money that would be devoted to it, the larger the sample you could have, and the greater fear that you'd put in people about non-complying. If on the other hand, it were a $100,000 program, you wouldn't get very far. So it would be a direct function of how stringently you really wanted to have the program.
Can I ask what size expenditure you or the governor will be recommending to the legislature?
In our fiscal note, I believe we've asked for $250,000, which assumes a fairly aggressive enforcement audit effort.
How many audits out of the 300,000?
We don't have any way of estimating it. It would just be dependent on what's the program's set up. I mean, one person can do it a day. We've asked for 3 or 4.
Three and four.
Thank you.
Kevin?
Brian's kind of touched on what I wanted to ask, just more of information for me. We've had a lot of difficulty on residential deals. We had a court case, of course, on residency requirements and job. Now, just what's the difference between that? We're looking at, let's, for example, voting. You resident here for 30 days, you can vote. but you gotta be here a year before you can get a hunting license. We're beginning to get so many different periods of time as far as residency requirements concerned. What are we gonna run into when we say that a resident of 30 years can get more money than a resident of 5 years? Are we gonna have a court case on that, in your opinion? It seems to me that a number of times I've asked for bills that I've tried to set up, and they tell me I can't do it on a residency deal because it's unconstitutional, it's illegal. What I want to know is what your opinion is it constitutional for us to have a residency requirement that will allow one person to get more money than another? Plus, another thing too, and we're talking about tax refunds, are the oil companies people or things when we start talking about tax refunds?
May I answer the first question first?
Yes.
First of all, with respect to residency requirement, bear in mind, although I have some legal training myself, I have not myself researched this question, so I would of course defer to the Attorney General for the final opinion. It's my impression that with respect to denying people rights, which they are guaranteed, for instance, under the Constitution, the right to vote, the right to run for office, things like that. The state has to balance against those rights competing interests that it has, such as administrability of conducting elections, the interest in having informed legislators instead of ignorant legislators. So in the case of a voter, it is presumed that 30 days is adequate for a voter to become aware of the issues that might affect him. He has a right to travel, he has a right to vote, and the state interest in conducting orderly elections allows that voter's application. You know, it can be processed in 30 days, and so that represents sort of the ultimate degree to which the state can deny a person the right to vote. Now, when it comes to running for the legislature, as I understand, it's the court upheld a one-year requirement. But you have to be residing in your district or in the state for a year. The idea being there that in addition to these other interests, the state had an interest in having legislators who were informed of the concerns of their constituents. And 30 days is just not long enough to be informed of the interests of your constituents. In fact, some could well argue that a year is not enough, particularly if you come from a district that is geographically large. On the other hand, when you're talking about conferring benefits, it may be that the balancing of competing interests is not so stringently reviewed. For instance, we already have the longevity bonus system, we have the pioneers' homes, there's the forgiveness, the exemption of people over 65 for taxes, from their property taxes. These are already in place, and although they've never been, to the best of my knowledge, finally adjudicated up to the Supreme Court, they stand as precedent that has been unchallenged. And it may or may not have any weight in the court, but there is an ongoing practice of allowing people who have been here for a longer period of time to enjoy greater benefits. And further, unlike some of these, where if the person can't vote, he forever loses his right to participate in that election, a person who comes here and has lived here for 6 months can, in 30 years, gain equal standing with a guy who's here 30 years now. I mean, all that's required is the time, the commitment, the exposure, and the contribution to Alaska of longevity. And anybody can do that, assuming they don't drop dead or something. So it's not barred to the newcomer forever. The longer he stays, the greater he will share. And I believe that that forms a basis for distinguishing, as well as this balancing thing between different competing interest in the state. As I say, in the one case you're denying a person a right, in the other case you're according one person a greater benefit. And I think there's a logical relationship there that would pass muster. But that's a personal opinion, not a legal opinion.
One of the few logical responses I've heard in a long time. But my other question.
Oh, yes, that's the tough one. Our corporations people. No, I don't believe so. I think corporations are allowed to have independent, separately recognized legal existence by sufferance of the state. The state allows that to happen. It is a franchise. It is a right that the state accords. It is different from being born. Once you're born, there's nothing the state can do to deny you your existence or your rights. Before 1865, states could. But since the passage of the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, states can't deny you your personhood, if you will. And the federal government never has been able to deny that to people. But corporations are creatures of the state. Without laws authorizing the formation of corporations, there would be no corporations. And in fact, it's an interesting thing, a footnote, if I may digress, Mr. Chairman, on antitrust. Do you know where that word comes from, antitrust? It's because at the turn of the century, in the 1800s, states were very restrictive as to who could do business. In order to do business in a state, you had to create a corporation in that state. A Delaware corporation couldn't do business in Ohio, for instance. So you formed a trust to own and control these corporations. You had separate legal entities, and that's why it's antitrust. It was to break that trust, the central control over these separate corporations. A little digression there, but it points out how important and how entrenched in history, you know, corporations as creatures of the state that exist by sufferance of the state, unlike individuals.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Very logical response.
Thank you.
Commissioner, you mentioned a report by the Institute for Social and Economic Research. Do you have that report with you?
No, sir.
Okay, are you familiar with it? Did you contact board? Or did you get a chance to look at it?
I have not seen it. I was...
Well, you see,
we can get you.
We
copy.
Can certainly get you a copy.
Well, I wanted to ask you a question about it. If you're not familiar with it, perhaps you won't be able to answer. I had heard that the report indicates that under the governor's plan, the vast majority of the money distributed under his tax reform concept would go to the rural areas, not to the urban areas.
Well,
have you heard of that?
I don't know. I'm not in a position to comment on that.
Well, I've heard that 75%, because of the longevity requirements, ends up going to the rural areas where most of the people were born and have 30 or 40 or 50 years longevity, as opposed to some of the urban areas where people have not quite that long of an average resident.
I'm not in a position to comment on that other than to say that I would assume that, you know, let's say the population of the state was 125,000 or thereabouts in 1959, that you would have had the comparable attrition in the bush or in urban areas or areas that have since become urban. Kenai may not be considered a rural area anymore, but I submit that in 1959 it was quite rural.
Okay, would you check that out for me? And give me a response as soon as you can.
Okay.
Maybe you could provide me a copy of that report.
We certainly will.
Secondly,
do I get one too?
Yes, send one to the rural members. I want to jump on the bandwagon. Also, you mentioned the way the governor's idea is put together. In simpler terms, could you answer it this way? The Freeman tax credit bill that passed here unanimously, I think, in both houses, if I remember correctly, a couple of years ago, provided for the first year $100, the second year $200, and the third year $300 credit against your state income tax. If I'm remembering this right, we're in the second year now, so people paying their taxes, people that are making up their taxes right now for last year, are going to get a $200 credit. Is that right?
Correct. If they filed a return last year.
Right. Okay, now, so next year, they're going to get a $300 credit. So let's assume we're talking about next year, where they're going to get this $300 credit. Under your scenario, how long would they have to live here, or what would they have to do? What kind of circumstance would they have to have been in before they get more than that $300 that's already in the statute?
Well, if you're talking about a distribution of $50 per dividend, and dividends accrue for each year of residency, you'd be looking at a six-year residence. To get to $300.
Six-year revenue.
That's right.
Okay. And then $50 for every year after that?
That's right. Up to
what?
We get to
up to what?
The number of years since statehood.
Which is
January 3.
20 years?
20 years.
But it's, this is the 21st year.
So in my case, since I was born here, 21 times 50, or
you get $1,050.
Whether or not I paid that much in?
That's correct.
Regardless of what my tax liability is.
That's correct.
What happens to $300 credit? Take that off after, before, after? Or how do you handle that? Repeal that?
I don't think the intention is to.
It's the greater of.
The greater of.
You either get the premium credit, you get the premium credit until this energy credit exceeds it, at which point it displaces or replaces it or displaces it.
Okay, so everybody that's 6 years
or less, we get the
$300. Or less, we get the $300. So there's a floor of $300 that's provided by the premium credit.
Assuming that you've been here for the, to get $300, you have to have been here for the two preceding years.
That's correct, yeah, all right.
Right. So assuming that you are a 3-year resident, between 3 and 6, you get $300.
Well, one of the things that just to, we're talking about concepts, and as a person who was born here, I have as strong a feeling of that, that that means something as anyone could have, I guess. And like everyone else, I resent people coming up here for a month or two. You live in Alaska, it seems to make a bigger difference than the 21st year that you live here. I mean, I don't know if the committee members can follow my thinking, but it, under the Freeman bill, that's automatically taken care of because it says, okay, the first year you get 100, and the second year you get 200, and the third year, and every year after that, you get $300. So there's sort of a threshold that after a while you really become a legitimate resident of the state, and everybody has equal rights. Whether you've been here 30 years or 4 years, you're equal in terms of that, in terms of that credit. Under your scenario, the longer you're here, the more equal you are in terms of the money you get, up to 21 years. So I'm just wondering whether, if you care to discuss that. I kind of like the Freeman concept better than that. I mean, after a while, it gets to be ridiculous. People saying, well, I've been here 19, so I get $50 more than you because you've only been here 18. And after that kind of thing, it seems to me to be somewhat pushing it, you know. A person like yourself, who hasn't been here 20 years, but who everyone would consider to be a full-blown, legitimate resident in terms of the both the suffering that you've had to do in terms of the cold winters and the travel and the getting kicked around by the finance committee, But also the contribution that you've made and the position that you're in, I think, you know, there are lots of people like yourself who haven't been here 21 years, but who certainly could claim to have the same kind of legitimacy. Are you, Orlo, are you following my point?
I would say that that's mostly a question of judgment in terms of where you draw the line. I mean,
right,
the governor has suggested as an initial line that you start with statehood and run forward. Now the question then becomes, well, what would you end up doing, for instance, in the year 2040? Would you give people, 81 years of residency if they've been here 81 years? Or would you sort of have that time period of 20 years slide along? If the answer is yes, you take 20 years, over 20 years, you treat them the same, then once again, it's just a question of degree to say, well, should it be 20 or should it be 18 or 15-year residence or whatever it is. What it will do then is it affects the number of dividends, and it affects at what point people begin being treated on an equal footing regardless of how much extra duration they may have.
Well, I guess I pretty much oppose that thinking because, you know, I'm upset about the guy that comes up here for a summer and when the termination dust hits the mountains, he takes off and takes his money with him. But I really I guess I also believe that Alaska still provides people an opportunity. That's one of the great things about Alaska, that, that our doors are open and you can come up here, and if you're willing to pay the price and work hard, that there are opportunities here that aren't provided in New Jersey and New York and Pennsylvania and even California anymore. So, and then that's what attracts people. I think that people right now have to have the same advantages that my parents had when they came up here, you know, 35, 40 years ago. So, I'm not sure that I would agree that, some person that's been here 2 years more than somebody else gets an extra $100. But whereas in the Freeman concept, whether or not it was actually consciously put in there, the way it works out is that after you've shown that you're not just a fly-by-night, that you're not just going to come and rip off the state's wealth and go back to a warm climate somewhere, and you've been here 3 years, I think you've amply demonstrated that you have some sort of real concern to live in this state, then you're treated equally. And in fact, every year you get that increment, but after 3 years, you're treated equally from there on in. So I'm wondering if, it seems to me it might be a better idea, even going with the concept that you have, that you said, okay, $100 the first year, $200 the second year, $300 the third year, and then say, okay, well, let's talk about the fourth year. Then the fourth year, then you get $1,000 or whatever it is that works out to be what you want to give people, rather than this continuing linear increment every. It seems to me you reach a threshold after a little while. It gets kind of ridiculous to make the difference. Do you care to respond to that, or did you already?
Well, I think I did. You know, it's mostly a question, as I say, of where you want to draw the line and say, after this point, people have made a substantially equal contribution, and hence, mm-hmm. You know, and contributions are more than just simply how much taxes you pay. Part of Alaska's heritage is the diversity of the people that we have here. There are very valuable but non-monetary contributions that a lot of people have made for service.
For comment, I see we're having a lot of problems on this, because I think each of us, we're talking about concepts, each of us has a different concept, and I have problems with the type of plan that you and Oral are supporting, in that, I can't see that what we're distributing is oil well, and I don't think we have to look at it in any other way. And to give somebody who's been here only 3 years, a large benefit, say somebody who makes $50,000 a year, a large tax benefit, simply because he pays tax, and to take somebody up in Cleo's district, for instance, who for the last 40 years has been hunting, fishing, and living on top of that oil, and to say that because he lives a subsistence lifestyle, that he can't benefit from that oil. I have a real problem with that. And last fall was the first time I really, sat down and started thinking about the tax issue, and I pretty much scoffed at Alaska Inc. and some of the direct distribution schemes. But the more I thought about it, the more it seems that's what we are distributing as well. That's the more equitable way of doing it. And maybe with some problem with a scheme that puts a large percentage into the bush, but. I would have a problem supporting any scheme that doesn't somehow distribute to everybody in an equitable manner. Perhaps it shouldn't be based on longevity, or maybe it should be some cutoff of 3 years or 5 years or whatever. But once somebody's achieved that, I don't think, I think everybody has to be treated equitably.
Well, just for the record, I want to say that I don't disagree with you. I was just, my comments shouldn't be taken to presume what I may be advocating or what I'm not advocating. I was just merely trying to pick apart things that he says, critically analyze them, see where the holes in this concept might be. On balance, it may turn out that this concept is better, or maybe we can have a hybrid of some other ones. I don't really know where I'd fall. Personally, I separate the questions. I look at tax reform as tax reform, and you should look at it from a Proposition 13 attitude. It doesn't really apply to Alaska too much, but you should look at it from that point of view. If you don't believe in taxes, then you don't believe in distributing the oil wealth is a different question, and I think it belongs to all the residents equally, regardless of how much they make or where they live. And where you call them a resident, that's a, I don't really know where I fall in that, but where you come resident, I don't know. But
no, I've just come to not to see that distinction between tax reform and distributing oil off your rent. I think I think it's a mistake to call it tax reform, but tax elimination or whatever. Because what you are doing is distributing oil wealth through that particular mechanism, and I don't think this legislature is going to do both this year.
That could very well be.
And of the two, I prefer something that equitably distributes.
Well, I think there'd still be a question before us of tax repeal or reduction, whether or not we have a lot of extra money. But when we do have a lot of extra money, it suddenly becomes mixed with the question of distributing it. And if, as you say, and I think your judgment might be right, the legislature's not going to do both, then you need to pick your side before you go in.
Mr. Chairman.
Or?
Would you yield just a second? The committee, the group that I told you before working on this, have Mr. Randolph very much in the back of our mind, and he's there whether we like it or not. So, you know, that's the question. We the legislature, either going to do something with the income tax, or Mr. Randolph is, you know, that's a fact.
That's definitely a consideration.
Yeah, well, I certainly know why using the income tax to be
But of course, you pointed out the other day that substantially the same has been interpreted
pretty loosely,
pretty loosely, so that you, as long as you do anything that you call it, that you probably get away with it in the courts. That's what you were pointing out.
Well, that was a decision on campaign disclosure. So.
Frank?
Yeah, well, I disagree with Joe on this one, that they are the same issue. I think they are two discrete issues. The issue of what are you going to do with people's tax money, and whether you're going to cut the amount of tax money, and what are you going to do with the oil tax money? Granted that having a large surplus gives us the opportunity, makes it easier to do something with people's tax money, but it is people's tax money. And I think we run into some problems when we try to combine them. One of those problems is in this proposal, if either you get the as it was once called, Freeman-Meekins tax credit of up to $300, or you get the other one, whichever is greater, that means, I did some quick calculations here, if the average length of residency is 6.5 years, based on that 2.6 million shares, that means half the people wouldn't benefit by our action. Half the people in the state wouldn't benefit. Now, that just doesn't seem equitable to me, to say that whatever we're going to do this year is only going to benefit those who've lived here more than 6.5 years, because there's some very productive people in this state that are doing a lot for the state that have lived here less than 6.5 years. So I think it's important to separate the issues.
Commissioner, I know you have another meeting to go to. Do you have a parting comment for us? Are there any other questions?
Well, are there any other questions of me? Well, in that case, I thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, for the opportunity to testify today and to listen in on
We'll be discussing
topic.
This issue with you again.
I look forward to it. I'm at your disposal.
Thank you. Mr. Randolph, I know you've been waiting patiently. You might have a few comments to make. Is that from carrying around the burden of government?
Must be something like that.
Burden of reform.
Mr. Chairman, as I understood, first, appreciate the opportunity to be here. And as I understood your comments on the floor this morning, the governor's going to be here, and I had not at that time been asked to testify, so I didn't come fully prepared to testify. So if I miss any points, I might invite myself back.
I think you're pretty familiar with the issue. You might be able to do this.
Okay, first, I think it's really, really imperative to make it extremely clear that, from my point of view at least, we are talking about two different issues. One is oil extracting resource income that we're talking about redistributing somehow or distributing somehow. Another is we're talking about people's earned income. And right now we have an extremely inequitable situation. And we have had for years. In fact, ever since the income tax was initiated, it's been inequitable. One whole segment of the population works and pays taxes, and another segment of the population doesn't work and doesn't pay taxes and receives most of the benefits. And that's a very inequitable situation. I think the major challenge that we have in Alaska is the type of society that we're going to leave. The biggest problem, as I see this, is the government has way too much money and the people have too little. And our challenge, in a nutshell, is to try to get to correct that situation. The statement made a little bit ago that people ought to pay for government. Well, if government and the people are in fact the same thing, then people are in fact paying for government. If we're spending $1 billion a year on government, and there's 400,000 people in the state, we're each paying $2,500 for government. That is our money, or is it not? Is it the government's money? If it is our money, we're each paying $2,500 for government. It really scares me, and it's a concept that really hadn't dawned on me until I got involved in this tax initiative, that there are people in this state, apparently a lot of them, and an awful lot of them in this administration, and apparently quite a few of them in the legislature, who thinks government just ought to collect taxes. You know, that's an inherent, not only right, but obligation of government to collect taxes. And that's scary to me. That's not what government ought to do. Government ought to do anything. It's to be the vehicle through which people pay for services that they're willing to pay for and they need and can't provide otherwise. And the concept that people just ought to pay government taxes or pay taxes to government is really a strange concept to me. I think it's really important to make the point that we are talking about an income tax. Well, initially it talks about income tax reduction because of the constitutional limitations on income tax repeal by the initiative process. What I have been talking about for a long time and am talking about now, that the legislature I hope will seriously consider, is an outright income tax repeal. And we're not talking about giving anybody anything of any other sort. We're just simply saying, hey, you earned X amount of bucks, you can have it back, or you can keep it. The state no longer needs it to provide services. And I think that's an extremely important point to make. It is earned income. It ought to be left with people who earn it, unless society as a total needs it to provide services. I don't think anybody make a decent argument for that in this case. Equity. We've heard an awful lot about equity. And I mentioned just briefly that we have had a situation where many people work, and the state collects it. I don't think anybody ever sell me on the point that as long as you're collecting taxes from one segment of the population, they're going out working and giving a month of their life to the state government, that and then we take that money and distribute it to everybody, you are redistributing wealth from the working class, the non-working class, and as was point made here, I think a little while ago, that from the urban and rural areas to the bush. I don't think there's any question about that.
People in my area, they pay taxes too.
Oh, I appreciate that. I'm just saying, ratio-wise, much more will go to the bush than not how much. Particularly if it's distributed on a longevity program such as the governor's energy tax credit we just talked about. Another point I think is important to make, and it may be just a little bit afield, but I think it's very important, is that the idea that oil income is non-renewable, or I think as Joe Hayes said, non-sustainable, is not a correct assumption. You can look at any other major oil producing state in this country, and they've been getting significant chunks of income for 50, 70, 100 years, in Pennsylvania's case, from oil income. I would admit that once you take a barrel of oil out of the ground and ship it off down the pipeline, that barrel of oil is gone. But there is absolutely no natural limits, I don't believe, we can make a good case, for the proposition that Alaska will be a major exporter of fossil energy for the foreseeable future. As a society, we've only been using fossil fuels for energy for less than 100 years. We can easily see 20, 50, 20, 25, 30 years down the road with our gas and oil. With just a little imagination, you'll see a lot further than that. I think anybody who's thinking at all realizes that coal gasification is about to become a big thing. Alaska has enough coal by the supply of the United States for hundreds of years.
16.
That's the whole United States, I think. But at any rate, I think you can make an awfully good case, as I think I said on the floor the other day, for the proposition that mankind, both in Alaska and America and worldwide, will leave far more fossil fuel in the ground than we're ever going to use. If we're going to go to fusion, solar energy, other alternative, if we don't make enough progress in the next 100 years with our technology and everything, that we don't substantially release ourselves from the bonds of fossil energy, I'll be extremely amazed. And I think all of you would be also. Therefore, I think that puts a whole new light on our economic picture in Alaska than when you buy what I call the big lie that we're about to run out of energy. There is no natural energy crisis anywhere. It's a political, economic control that's causing our problem. And that does reflect on Alaska, the problem that we have, the dilemma we have before us, and that is that we have a resource which is at this point in time very valuable, and that value has increased many fold in just the last few months, last couple of years. And we're receiving the benefits of that. I think it's safe to assume that as long as the market for fossil fuels, that our children and grandchildren will also receive the benefits of it. That being the case, you don't need a big state savings account. A real question in my mind is what kind of society we're going to leave for our kids and our grandkids, and beyond that, whether we're going to have a big government. And the present administration equates all the time, every time, everything our present governor says, he's worried about the health of the state, the economic health of the state. I'm not nearly as concerned about the economic health of the state as I am the people in the state. And I think you just look around a little bit, and you can look in the Bush area, you can look in Fairbanks, you can look in the Palmer area. The fact the state's got $2 or $3 billion surplus isn't helping those folks at all. And you can have a very huge state surplus. You can tie it up in a permanent fund. And you can still have a bunch of peasants out there who don't have money to buy their oil or their food or pay their rent.
So, peasants. Is that what you call people out there, peasants?
What I call myself.
Okay? That's what I think.
Yeah. I refer to myself all the time as my peasant.
Appreciate that.
In response to a couple of the questions, I think, that have been brought up, and the commissioner here a moment ago, listening to him, you would think he talked about old people, young people, poor people, women, just about everybody, isn't going to benefit from this income tax effort to either substantially reduce or repeal it. There's an awful lot of support out there in the TUIs for people who aren't going to benefit. Of course, I guess maybe just for some they don't understand. But, I think most people out there think that they're going to benefit substantially from being able to keep their own paycheck. It's not too hard for them to figure it out. They take their pay stub each week or month and look at it, and they can see how much the federal feds get and how much the state gets, and they know they're going to get it. It seems to me the real point is that you can't have any equitable distribution of our resource income as long as you don't have, as long as you're taking from one segment of people and then giving it to everybody in general. You are, in fact, redistributing some people's earned income to everyone. I want to be very, very clear on the point that I have not opposed ever Hammond's Energy Credits Program or anybody else's distribution program. I will favor and will help promote any piece of legislation that distributes money from the state back to people. And I think through a variety of programs, we can do a very good job and treat everybody for equity. But it seems to me the first thing we have to do is to give the working people in the state back their earned income. Questions?
Right. Yeah, I'd like to start out by disputing pretty strongly one of your first statements, which is to say that we've got two classes, one group who pay taxes and the other who reap all the benefits. Our number one expenditure in state government is on education. You get that whether or not you pay taxes. The taxpayer gets just as much benefit from that as a non-taxpayer. The next biggest expenditure is transportation, and you get that whether or not you pay taxes. In fact, probably the bigger beneficiaries are the taxpayers, because they're the ones that can afford to fly around or can afford to drive around. If you look at the capital projects, that's benefiting the people who are working on those projects, which are taxpayers. The loan programs, nobody who's not paying taxes is going to get a loan. In fact, for the state loan programs, you've got to file your last 3 years' tax returns in order to get a loan. So you know that those people are taxpayers. Then finally comes social services, which is the group I think you were referring to, and I really think you're misleading people to act as if there's, you know, the good guys and the bad guys, the way you did in that opening statement.
Yeah, Mr. Rogers, I would say simply this, that in portion, when you add that all up, everybody receives, if you want to call education, highways, transportation, et cetera, benefits, everyone receives them equally, reasonably so. And again, I would say the rural areas, Bush areas particularly, receive more. More money goes into cost of transportation in those areas and per capita than do in the urban areas. And then when you do get social services, you do come into a disparity situation, without any question.
But that's primarily not state money. The bulk of the social services money is federal money, and of course your tax bill has, your initiative has nothing at all to do with federal taxes.
I had a couple of questions. Oh, did you? I didn't see Sal.
I was formulating my idea here. I want to kind of repeat something on that. Mr. Randolph, it isn't just the people in the rural villages who profit by the transportation coming their way. It's the people in the urban centers who are selling the product out there. they get just as much out of that transportation subsidy as the guy who lives at the other end, at the receiver. Maybe even more so, because that seems to be how we keep alive. We're constantly pumping money into the business economy. There's a concept that we're all living out, and I'm trying to fight it through in my own mind. I haven't gotten it crystallized yet. Maybe you can answer. Do you believe that we as citizens of the state have a social responsibility?
What do you mean by social responsibility?
A responsibility to those of us, those around us. Do I have a responsibility to Brian? Do I have a responsibility to the people of my community? Do I have a responsibility to the people of Juneau? Do I have a responsibility to the people who live in Leo's district? As a citizen of the state.
Ms. Smith, I think that if you want to vote, no, I don't believe you have a legal responsibility to anyone else.
Okay, there's where we're having a real split, even in trying to talk about the tax issue. Because I was brought up to believe that I have a responsibility to the people around me, a moral responsibility and a social responsibility. But our level of trade is monetary. We used to trade for services and other materials and commodities, and we put it down to monetary. And as you and I and our brothers and sisters in the state have stopped giving of our time and our personal being to help one another, we have started asking for it to be done through state services. If I don't help my brother out of the gutter by my own time and personal sense of responsibility, I pay my tax to the state and I ask the state to do it for me. And we're removing the human hand-to-hand helping and put it on a monetary basis, which is part of what our taxes are going for. We're asking to remove ourselves further from association with our fellow man. I mean, it's a broad concept, I grant you. But that's all we're talking about, is building islands of ourselves. And you know, that's coming down the far end of the pole. I think that has to be considered, too.
Ms. Smith, I agree with you, totally. The difference in our concept, I guess, if I'm understanding it correctly, is that I think that you ought to be able to voluntarily help wherever you wish, and so should I. I don't believe that a group of people sitting at the table should be able to vote that I should have to help anybody who I choose not to help.
Just a difference in personal responsibility.
No, I may
other
have,
question.
No.
Other questions on Mr. Randolph's concept? Let me ask you one thing that is kind of general, but we've been allowing this discussion to be general because we're not talking about specific bills, but more conceptual approaches. You mentioned a transfer of wealth, and I think you've got something of a point on that. There's a lot of transfers going on, not just taking personal income taxes from people who are working in this state, the state taking them, and then perhaps using them for social services that benefit people who are not paying as high a percentage of taxes as those people that aren't getting those services. That's certainly happening to some extent, and I know you at least sounded like you opposed that, and some people think it's a good idea, but let's not get into the debate on that. But one of the things that interests me is that there's another transfer of wealth that's going on. In fact, the greatest transfer of wealth in the history of the world, I mean, it's not even close, is going on right now in history, and it's one of the most amazing things historically, is that the money's coming from the consuming nations, fossil fuel consuming nations, to the fossil fuel producing nations. Which coincidentally, the case happens to be that most of the producers are underdeveloped and most of the consumers are the developed nations. So there's this tremendous multi-billion dollar transfer of wealth from like America and other westernized cultures to the Middle East, Venezuela, and other underdeveloped areas. Alaska's part of that. And our transfer of wealth, since 100% of our, at least the crude oil, is being sold within the U.S., our transfer wealth is kind of interesting. It's coming from the lower 48 consumer through the oil companies to us. But the portion that we get is just pretty small compared to the portion that the oil companies get. And, you know, one of my concerns is large government. I think when government gets large, it gets to be hard to handle. And but I think the same way of anything that gets large, whether it's government or whether it's private enterprise. And some of the multinational corporations are reaping tremendous profits and in having increases in the wealth that's being transferred to them because of this same mechanism that's going on. You know, and some of those corporations, I know one of the major ones, I won't name it, but I read recently that their gross sales is greater than 130, the gross national product of 113 nations in the United Nations, which I think everyone knows. So, and of course, the total revenue in the state of Alaska happens to be coincidentally the same as the gross sales of McDonald's food chain. So in terms of relative bigness, there are a lot of other entities that are larger than we are. The Board of Regents of the University of California system has a $6 billion surplus, or did last year, in their system. There are a lot of different comparisons that can show you that, yeah, there might be some large numbers here and large government here, but relative to some of the other transfers, it's fairly small. And I'm just wondering how are you only concerned in your view with the transfers that are going on in the government, or are you also concerned with the transfers going on in the corporations? And I make a difference between large corporations and the mom and pop type that really is the backbone of this country.
I totally agree with the concept that the major oil companies are certainly a different entity altogether than the normal Chamber of Commerce member.
Right.
And that I think the intent of my remarks was to deal with the situation we have here in Alaska, because that's what we're dealing with. You know, what the Board of Regents of California, the University of California, have, can't do much about that. I think it's very important that we develop a tax structure, or the lack of tax structure in the state, that allows, well, the biggest difference between, say, Alaska and Texas is that in Texas is a state that has had and still does have huge deposits of gas and oil. But they're the individuals, 100,000, 200,000, maybe even several million individuals actually own oil wells and gas wells. And the people there directly own the resource. And I think that's a much healthier situation, certainly from a freedom point of view, than what we have here, where the state owns everything. And the wealth is pumped out of the ground, passed over to people in the state treasury, and we sat here trying to figure out somehow, some way to redistribute it. Where in Texas, the market system took care of that thing in a very natural way.
Okay, if there are any other questions, we'll recess for 10 minutes and then take up budget limits and HCR and COVID.
Those pictures are tax collectors.
Any of your peasant constituency call you lately? Or?
Yeah, I got some peasants in my district too.
I thought Leo was going to go across the table at that point.
He means well, I'm sure, but golly.
Easter says the wrong thing.
Those of us from Fairbanks wish you had crawled across the table.
Yeah, that's just politics. Anyway, you guys, you're a little nervous. You hear these footprints of the footstep behind you. You look back, here comes the libertarian.
You know, it's true. There were four of them that ran past. And he got elected, and the other three did not necessarily run bottom.
One of them's now on the borough assembly.
Yes.
That's my point.
Yes, and what really is frightening is people who said, I voted for more libertarians than you.
The point, though, is that, Oral, that both the Republican and Democratic parties can take the libertarians' good ideas. We just don't have to agree to try to sell off the school system to the private sector.
See, if they were smart, they wouldn't come up with any bad ideas. When you're in the minority, you jump on all the good ideas and disclaim any responsibility.
They want no public roads and no public schools.
Toll roads, private schools, and pay toilets. What the...
I want the toilet.
You vote for all appropriations, you vote against all taxes.
Vice Chairman has certain prerogatives. Eventually they have to be quiet. Since there's no, is there any pressure? Good time for me to bring up the point.
Lock your door.
If you want to follow in this budget book, there's a bunch of them right up there behind the secretary. On page 9, it says page 21 is an overview percentage increase over the, if you'll look at the second to last column, total operating budget increase, it says 14.7. Okay. Now, you've heard the widely touted 12% increase for the governor. Are you all on 21?
Yeah.
Yeah, but it doesn't say 14.7. Second. I'm looking at the wrong place.
Second column.
Second column from the right.
Wow.
Got it? Everybody on the same?
Takes me.
Okay. Now, in headlines in my town, it said the governor has a 12% increase. So I just want to go from there and show you. Even in his own document, it says 14.7. In fact, there's another page of this document that says 17.7, which is more correct. Look at education. It says what?
2.6 and 2.7.
Oh, we'll bring that up in a minute. Okay, under education, as Pappy pointed out, it says 2.7. Yeah, I see the press as well. It says 2.7. What, the reason that that, what is that, Pappy? 30% of the budget, education, something like that? Okay, so when you have 30% coming in at 2.7, naturally the total percentage is going to be lower. Mm-hmm. But the reason that's 2.7 is that they have, they haven't counted any increase whatsoever in the foundation fund. They've got it in for exactly the same dollars and cents as last year. No increase whatsoever, which the governor, even his budget message said 30 million, right? That's 3 percentage points. In addition, there has been some improvement there because of, you have to correct me if I'm wrong, but the transportation contracts came in lower, about $2 million lower, something like that.
I was going to say between 1.75, 2.5, it's varied.
This is not new, they do this every year.
So, well, I'm just trying to get you on the same sheet here. So, because it's relevant to your considerations as subcommittee chairman as to what limits you're going to pick. Okay. So, the real increase in education is at least 5.7, at the very least. Is that where your 100 million are? What budget is it? Native plains.
Mr. Chairman, on that topic that you're speaking of, on your page of education, on page 30, it shows education total is 483 going up to 581. And yet it doesn't, that doesn't reflect on the page 21 that you're showing.
The figure's not in there.
You're misreading it. That would be 79. You want to go from FY80 adjusted 559 to FY81 581.
That would be from what? Then 559 to 581, I presume.
Right. That's all. But if you look down at whatever foundation formula is,
that's
the fourth one down on the first section. Foundation formula components 216, yeah. 661 last year. This year they're coming in for 216,395, a net reduction of 300,000, which we know isn't going to be the case. Because you're looking at, what, $83 million?
Yeah.
And the governor's already agreed to $30 million, so each $10 million is 1 percentage point.
This is what put me off on getting my report back to you. When I started reading all these figures that come out of this thing, plus one that they handed me, it threw me completely out of gear.
Okay, now, so you got to add 3 percentage points to the 14.7, and you get 17.7. When I went and talked to Jerry Reinman about this, he said, well, it took me 2 weeks to realize that we weren't going to make a 12% budget. So what we did was take the capital budget, reduce it, put what we're going to put in the capital budget in the supplemental budget, had a 17.7% increase in the operating budget, had a reduction overall in the capital budget, so we'd end up at 12.9%. So that's the name of that. Jay Hogan just pointed out to me that in addition to the 17.7, there's roughly $45 million in pay raises that the governor's gonna be putting in by budget amendment. So that's another 4%. How many, about 4%? 4.5, 45 million, about 4%. So add another 4%, you get 21.7% increase. And which way is your
retroactive? I bet it's not in the year 81 adjustment.
No, it's coming in.
This year,
it's not in there. I think this is the one. I got this from Allison. So this
45 million. Who's one there presently?
No, it doesn't.
See, that makes it even higher.
And Milt just mentioned, which way is your error that you found?
It would increase the percentage also because they have budgeted in the capital portion 300 million. Native claims fund payoff. But actually only 190 of that would be paid through FY81 ordinarily. So 110 million of that is in excess of the revenues that would be coming into the native clinics automatically, and they forgot to count that.
That's 10%.
110 million.
Yeah. Well, how do you want to count? That'd be a capital
it's
budget.
Not the, yeah, it's capital budget. It's not part of the operating budget.
But if they're using capital budget to offset anyway, it's an offset.
Well, if you take the 162 and added it to the 60, that'd be 222 million, which is about 300% increase from last year's capital budget. No matter how, we, how you slice it, this baby's a lot higher than it looks, yeah.
Except the pay raises, if they're not, if the, we're also going to do FY80 pay raises, I assume, and that would raise the FY80 adjusted, so that that would be one force in the other way. The more we can add into FY80, the smaller the FY81 increase is.
But well, does FY80 adjusted count supplemental?
It's supposed to make allowance for supplemental.
So you're right. If we, the more we added into the 80 base, the less the percentage increase would be.
That's why they did a supplemental capital budget.
Yeah.
No, a supplemental capital budget isn't figured in there.
Then they had a negative increase.
Yeah.
Well, from 200.
But they decreased their 81 capital budget by doing a supplemental budget.
Yeah. Decreased the percentage.
So they did use a supplemental capital budget.
All done with the winners.
Get on with this.
It's way more than a cheap shot.
I might point out something else too.
I think they were
there in that government transfer in certain departments around education, for example.
I know.
Right when you start the Commission of State Council on Arts has been added to the education budget.
Yeah.
Being transferred in, and I don't think that it's reflected in that first budget figure.
Yeah, there's a lot of budget, the governor's budget amendments that aren't in there yet. So
I think we should set a lot of accommodation though.
I think you can safely assume that the governor's budget, operating budget increase, is at least 22% over last year. That's a very, on the average. Now, even here, he admits that social or health is 34.1% increase. Brian, have you looked at that? Is that general fund? Oh, that's yours.
Yeah, it's Medicaid, GRM.
But it's general fund?
No, some a lot of it's federal.
Well, the general fund alone is, no, the general fund is 34%.
Oh, yeah, it is 34% in the general fund, right?
Is that what the general fund is?
That's what it says here.
Sorry, GR net, I think.
Milt, do you have public protection?
No, Paul Schroeder does.
Schroeder does, and you got it? That's the lowest one, other than, they didn't increase that one much, I guess.
Low. Then comes the university.
Where's the university?
They only got 17%.
Yeah, the university is the second lowest if you don't count education. That's funny.
Or they tied to social services, basically.
Okay. Anyway, for your own, what I would like you to do as soon as possible, those of you that haven't done it, I know, Sal, you responded, but said that you'll get something in later or something, is when you can figure out a limit, I would like you to set it. Now, this is a departure, so I'm trying to allow the subcommittee chairman the authority and the power to make these decisions themselves, and as long as they come in somewhat reasonable, we'll go with them. But if somebody comes in and wants an 85% increase, well then, you know, the committee's going to have to cut that down. But last year we set it by full committee, and a lot of it was at my suggestion. So I'm trying to, you know, re-raise that and let the subcommittee chairman actually have those kind of decision making.
Mr. Chairman, because I got a real question on what you really want. You know, we're working on these budget categories. We don't even have, you know, we really haven't had the time to go through them. I don't know what all the, there's 24.9% increase in development, 19.8% increase in general government. Some of those are new programs, some of them are other things. You know, yeah. We really haven't had time to look at it, take testimony on it. I don't know what kind of a limit you want me to set that's realistic. I think the best thing I can tell you is I'll hold it as low as possible. You know, that I'm not going to necessarily approve everything the governor wants, but I don't know how I can tell you I want to hold it to a 20% increase and even be halfway honest about it, or I want to hold it to a 15% increase because I don't even know for sure what the hell it is. That is there. And you know, and maybe I'm understanding it wrong. Maybe you want something different.
I'm having much the same problem that Jim is. I
of course, I haven't really, frankly, I haven't really gotten too far into it, but I'm going to have some problems. For instance, you know, last year we had the CIP employees, if I remember right, my figures, we had 1,367 authorized slots for CIPs.
Don't count that.
All right. Okay, but then transportation, they have about $28 million increase, around almost, you know, roughly 20% increase in their budget. 307 new employees. Well, see, what I've got to do is dig out how much, how many of those are CIP employees and this kind of thing to really know what they've done. When I, if they put CIP employees on board and our direction or accounted for in our direction, you know, I can't really fault them for having 307 new employees, but they damn well better be justified, or I'm going to come unglued when you talk about $28 million increase in 307 employees. So I need a little time. What I would like to have, and you know, if we can't have it, I would like to have some direction as to some goal from the overall committee, because if Brian is going to be very, very generous with the university, I'm not going to be all that tight with the ferry system type thing. You know, I need to be coordinated with the rest of the world.
Well, I was trying to build it up from the other direction. We can reverse direction of it. The problem I have is that, of course, as chairman, people ask me what our goal is going to be and what we're looking at, and it's kind of hard to keep telling, well, we don't have any idea, you know. And secondly, as you pointed out, when you don't have any idea where you're going, you sometimes you end up in a place you don't want to be. If you, the first page on the budget, if you look at it and you say, just look at it, you say, looks pretty good, I'll accept it. And if you do that on every page and add it up, all of a sudden you got a 50% increase. So you have to say, where am I going, and look at all of them together, kind of, as everyone here knows. The other thing is that Gardner, in a press conference tomorrow, Gardner's going to talk about a lot of the Democratic goals and different things. And one of the things he's going to mention, wants to mention, and is asking to provide in the data, is what we're looking at in terms of budget increase, because that's one of the things the public's concerned about and the press is concerned about. Are we going to come down here and just open up the Treasury and go crazy, or are we not? And the governor's been widely touted at 12%, so he's asked me to come up with some sort of limit. What he wanted to do was say, take the governor's budget as a base, add into it what you think are some pretty well supported Democratic priorities, and then see where you are.
But if I take that government budget there, it looks like 2.6%, and start, hell, right off the bat, I'm going to look like a hog just to get things in line.
Well, we all understand that. You've been acting like a hog all along.
Well, but I guess I'm still not understanding exactly what you want. I don't know how you can set a limit without knowing what's in the budget. For example, in general government, I think it is, there's a whole new program, Regulatory Reform and Review Committee or something, which is a couple hundred thousand bucks. I don't even know if that's needed. You know, that's the new thing that, Parasite, what's his name?
McConkie.
He has gotten for himself. And, you know, that's something I want to look pretty hard at before I decide that that's a needed program. And that's going to make a big difference on my budget.
I'm going to tell Bill Ray, you made some. You were talking about Bill Ray, I'm going to tell
him. Well, anyway, you get my point?
Yeah.
I'm not even sure. You know, if you want me to set a percentage, I'll tell